If you think you will side with the Alaska position on disposition of D2 lands, one would be naive to think this. More likely, he will hammer out his congressman to lock up everything before Alaska comes up with more incredible taxation schemes that he will ultimately pay as a consumer. In summary, I urge you to go slow on these tax proposals until you find out all the ramifications of raising taxes under the scheme is proposed. Also attempt to justify the need for these additional revenues. When we elected you, our representatives, we certainly never believed that your direction was to come to Juneau and harpoon your constituents. I, for one, have every confidence that you will not. And in the final analysis, common sense, good judgment, and fair play will prevail. I want to leave you with one final thought. Like you, I'm very proud of being proud of my Alaskan heritage, and I'm very glad to call Alaska my home. However, we're coming of age and becoming a significant voice to be reckoned with in this vast global village we share with the rest of the country and the rest of the world. If we are to survive and prosper, we must conduct ourselves in a forthright, business-like manner and expect to be judged and dealt with accordingly. Many years ago, a famous man stated that taxation without representation is tyranny. Not too long ago, I understand that a taxpayer in one of the lower 48 states had reason to say, taxation with representation ain't too high either. I hope we never forget our great state to be a focal point of similar ridicule. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to applaud him for one thing. If I don't like to pay taxes either. I want to ask one question. Do the present state budgets provide anywhere near the required services, not to the corporations, but to the people in the district where you live? Do you need more state dollars in your district than you're now getting?
I think if you wanted to get the North Slope into perspective, we should have started 50 years ago to do that. Right now, the borough, we have our own borough. We do get our state revenues, and it's still not enough.
Do you have any, just a little further, Mr. Chairman. Do you have an idea? I'm asking you this because I can't find a more expert place to get it. We heard it from the oil company, all of us, that what we're trying to tax is far beyond our needs. If this is really true, we've got a pretty strong point. But do you know what the need over the next 10 or 15 years during the producing life, shall we say, Trudeau Bay is, in your district? Do you know what they're going to be in millions of dollars, a percentage raise over what you're getting in your share right now? I think that one of the best answers on that can come from Navy Corporation.
First of all, I think you're assuming that Pluto Bay is the only thing to be found up there. I think if you will find it, how do you take something that is confidential and lay it out, which is like to show to all the members of the committee that we have reasons to believe there is a lot more than Prudhoe Bay up there. And I think that it's not going to be your only tax base for the next 30 years.
I'm referring, Madam Chairman, to Prudhoe Bay as probably the only big field of state-owned land to provide you and I and our children state of the money rather than from taxing the Navy Corporation or somebody else.
Well, I don't see how you're not going to derive from our land. We're going to have 5.5 million acres. They've been picked and selected. We now own 3.4 million acres. Now this month they're starting up the first well. Next winter they start up the next one and many more after that. And if you find more and more major fields, how can you just talk about and only focus on just Pluto Bay alone?
can't answer you that. I haven't seen any other fields yet.
Well,
I'd like to see
them.
I'd like to see them.
Could I answer part of his question, Madam Chair?
Surely it would lame.
John, I think your question would make sense if all things were equal. If every village had water now, or electricity now, schools now, past neglect, benign neglect, but neglect anyway, then we could give you $1.50. I don't know. I don't think anybody in this room.
My reason for asking the question, Madam Chairman, is that I think that Alaska, particularly rural Alaska, has been compared to Appalachia in more times than one. It may not always be true.
It's been compared to the only area in the United States worse than that.
Yes, it's certainly been compared that way, Madam Chairman. And when I look at that, as well as the needs that I notice in our urban communities, I don't see an excess of state dollars a few years down the pipe. I wonder how the legislator 10 years from now is going to make both ends match without, as Monty Taylor says, having to raise the oil company's taxes some more.
Madam Chairman, I think maybe we tried to change the North Slope. We created the borough just like anybody else under all the laws. And then what's the next thing you gotta do? You changed all the tax laws. You said North Slope's gonna get it all. We were trying to change that so that the people didn't have to compare it to wherever in the different parts of the world.
I think if you check the record, you'll find that I never advocated for individual tax authorities.
States that but we lost.
That was done in that 1973 special session that you thought was so good.
Not so bad.
Mr. Lane, Mr. Dean, did you
hear something?
Madam Chairman, my name is Roger Lane, and I'm here as an employee and a representative of Bristol Bay Native Corporation. My testimony will be very brief, and it shall not be technical, nor shall it address any single bill. We have tried that, Madam Chairman. We have brought the best people up in prior sessions of the legislature. For one time, we brought the guy that wrote the taxing manual for each individual field in California, and you guys ignored him. And we tried being very technical, proper, and legal. The result was people said we got in bed with oil. Some bed, Madam Chairman. I mean, worse yet, some bed partners. We don't mind being accused of getting in bed, but we are very selective of being in bed. The result is that I think I should like to address part of my testimony, at least, to the simple fact that I've sat here and listened to your two experts and the Commissioner of Revenue. And nowhere in there is anything brought out about us. Your focus on Prudhoe Bay leaves some significant cracks into which we fall. Not analyzed yet, because we have a different economic structure for the development of mineral resources. All mineral resources. Hard rock, oil, and gas. Much different, much more complicated. I spent a year being chairman of a study group on the finances found in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. On oil alone, according to standard accounting principles, there are 8 separate methods to determine how to share revenue, the 30-70 thing that Oliver spoke to. Under those 8 things, there are 48 different options under which you could exercise. Result is we are now in court, Native against Native, on how we're going to bookkeep Section 7I of the Claims Act. Now, the trouble is that we now have another set of laws telling us how we're going to bookkeep our taxes. SEC tells us what kind of laws we're going to bookkeep for them. Somebody said this was a lawyer's nightmare, this Claims Act. It's fast becoming an accountant's nightmare as well. There are several problems, being one, a native, being two, an Alaska citizen, and three, owning oil with potential for mineral development. And every year the rules change. And every year it becomes more difficult to project what's going on. It's not stopping, simply because we can't hide what we do through multinational investments or anything else. Someday we might get there, but we're not there yet. Everything we do is here, by us, for us, and it will benefit everybody. I tend to agree that we need a general philosophy of where this state is going. We are the one governing entity in the United States, taking cities, boroughs, counties, states into account, that can generally plan on a rational basis, at least for 10 years. But we're not doing that. We're still running our state from crisis to crunch. We make little deals that require a vote by Wednesday on gas. We did a crisis to crunch thing on oil. We did it on timber. We did it on gold. Now you're doing it to us, and it becomes kind of personal. I don't like, the man says, I don't mind if you do it to them. That's different. But then the taxes, the concepts, everything that's changing in these things result very heavily on us, because we do have different economics, we do have different constituents, we do have different stock, and we do have a different responsibility to Alaska. And we would admonish that these things rate as serious a consideration as anything else you've heard today. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Larry?
Madam Chairman, us in Bush, Alaska, all the way from Barrow, must admit that our studies and our rationale have come up with some of the same opinions as people from Houston or Dallas or wherever else.
We get up the liquor.
My name is Larry Deneen. I am the Executive Vice President of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and I am speaking in that capacity today. The Arctic Slope Regional Corporation has consistently opposed major tax revisions in the state oil and tax structure. We would like to take this opportunity to explain our rationale, as well as learn and attempt to comprehend the motivation of our state, both the legislative and the executive branches, to pursue such great increases. The Arctic Slope Regional Corporation is one of the 12 regional corporations in the state of Alaska. It is now 5 years old, and along with the others, has done amazingly well, considering all the hurdles that it has encountered and the amount of knowledge that it has had to ingest and digest. We, along with our sister regional corporations, our business-for-profit corporations, the same as any other business corporation in the state of Alaska. There are also 200 village corporations. They are also land owners or would be landowners. They need help to get their land. And most of them are also profit corporations. This is an amazing infusion of private land ownership, evolving business and corporate management, and potential for human and economic development in the state of Alaska. We know the internal problems of the development of corporation and the orientation and training and the digestion of a sociological evolution that is indeed occurring throughout Native Alaska. We know of the misunderstanding and the critique of the efforts of these new corporate leaders by those who watch from the sidelines and have their comments. On balance, I might say that the positive aspects far outweigh whatever weaknesses or failures that may have occurred. The success of the startup is indeed amazing. However, the external forces over which we have lesser control or impact concern us. The major one is the business climate of the state of Alaska. We, the native corporations, must collectively face the responsibility of ownership of 40 million acres. I cannot speak for the rest of the corporations, so let me address what the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation is trying to do for our benefit, and we hopefully believe for the benefit of the entire state of Alaska. We don't think the state has to produce the income. We think the citizens and the corporations can, and we want the chance. The Arctic Slope Regional Corporation has 3.4 million acres within the state of Alaska. Of that land, and with good luck and hard work, we will gain the rest, and that will be a total of somewhat over 5 million acres, with good luck within the next 2 years. In this case, we're going to need your help again. Congress will decide some of those acres. Land conveyances to the other corporations only amount to 400,000 acres at this point in time. Consequently, there is much to be done and much to be done in the state to help this to happen. The Arctic Slope Regional Corporation has had to borrow and spend $3 million or better to address the amazing hurdles that exist in this complex world to simply gain the land that Congress stated the government shall immediately convey as of December 1971. It took quite a stroke of business to gain the geological and geophysical information necessary to make the intelligent land selections that we have had to make. To do that, we needed to study 13 million acres. We had to cause and have caused to happen just that, and it was done in a little over 2 years. To those who were initiated in the field, it was a sheerly impossible task. We have caused that effort to happen, and we have made our land selections, and we are very hopeful. Our rationale has been to develop our corporate structure, develop subsidiary corporations that could give employment opportunities and provide business management opportunities for us to learn and to make intelligent choices concerning our land and then to gain our land. I would like to emphasize again, there have been 3,800,000 acres of land interim conveyed to the citizens of Alaska under the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, and 3.4 million acres of those 3.8 are in the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. So there's problems throughout the state that need to be addressed. Ladies and gentlemen of the Resource Committee, the potential of our lands of which I speak, except for those that are for subsistence purposes, are hydrocarbons, oil, gas, coal. The economic potential cannot be realized until that oil, gas, and coal are found, their value determined, and ways to found to reach the market. The state of Alaska has, since the discovery of Prudhoe Bay, zeroed in on the oil and gas industry and what it has found at Prudhoe Bay as if it were the only and the one source for your income from here on out. This extraordinary upward adjustment of taxes and tax structure each legislative session affects our opportunity to develop our own opportunities. The royalty and tax that you presently extract or will extract with the statutes on the books already are the highest in the nation. The new taxes that you are considering not only tend to dictate how oil and gas is to be produced and delivered, according to those that have helped us, because you have to rearrange how you do it if you're going to tax them different ways all the time, but contemplate an amazing further increase in that tax. Some of the attitude expressed in the halls of the legislature seems to say that's okay, they can afford it. They can't leave the state because of the resources here. To answer that simply, why is the United States importing 50% of its hydrocarbons? Ladies and gentlemen, the potential of Alaska is not totally at Prudhoe Bay. And I respectfully request that we quit addressing our taxing efforts and our policy as if it were. The proposed bills would either deter, distract, and hurt the efforts of many of your citizens, especially those that are in the Native Claim Settlement Act area. We cannot be successful in the effort to develop 3 to 5 million acres of hydrocarbon potential with a business and tax climate that deters rather than attracts the necessary capital for such development, and a tax structure that not only extracts a higher return than elsewhere in our country, but one that tends to dictate the policy of extraction, production, and delivery. We do not believe that there is a viable substitute for the effort of the very industry that is necessary for us to harvest, and deliver our resource. We know we don't have those skills. Such policy also detracts, inhibits, and certainly does not aid and abet the development of transportation modes that would also allow us to extract our resource and get it to market. We will, within a week, be in Washington to try to help solve some way to get our resource when we do find it out. And again, we're going to need the state's attention on that matter. We have appeared at each legislative session prior to and since the passage of the Land Claim Settlement Act. But I must confess that we have not been invited to testify or address any major positive effort to aid or help to nurture the growth of probably the greatest latent potential this state has in a people, a job resource, and yes, a long-term tax benefit. Those are the people and lands directly affected by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. On the other hand, we have found it necessary to attempt to dissuade you from major tax plans that hit the heart of the 3 major development potentials of all the regional corporations: oil and gas, mining, and timber. And the major land management schemes that you have asked us to address when we haven't even received our lands yet, and we don't really have the knowledge of them, especially from the point of view that you people say. We are young, viable, developing business corporations. Whether we succeed or fail will depend in great part on the business climate of our state. Consequently, we ask that you defer considerations of major tax schemes or modifications at the present, and instead direct the departments of government of this great state to, number one, determine why the Internal Revenue Service attitude toward regional and village corporations and the state's inadvertent agreement with the Internal Revenue Service has the potential to bankrupt almost every regional corporation. Number two, how the attitude of certain powerful congressional committees and departments of the federal government and in an unknown position of the state would block the flexibility and potential transportation of the major resources of this state, especially those from the bush. Number three, how the lack of a positive attitude towards the development of resources and jobs deters the development of jobs in urban or rural settings. 14% unemployment can't be cured by a permanent fund. And discover with us, number four, the amazing development of people and potential that exists in the regional and village corporations. Number five, help us find a way within the many different departments of state government, all we really but hear about is revenue, that can aid the realization of our potential. You in turn will be amazed at the treasure house of people and resources that have evolved so rapidly you couldn't possibly have kept track. Frankly, we need your help in both very general and most specific ways, and we will not do nearly as well without it.
Thank you, Larry. Are there any questions of Mr. Benin? Might comment on your reference to jobs. The legislature has appointed a special committee. Senator Rader appointed this committee a few weeks ago that will be, that's one of the things I'll be looking at. First time we've ever had this particular type of committee for development and trying to get Alaska on year-round income rather than the ups and downs and peaks and crises that we have all the time. Senator Rader?
Can I ask a couple of questions?
Really?
You know, we keep addressing and in very general terms, not only, I think you're wise to address this problem in a general term, that is, what's a fair share, and we should get off of state and federal lands and start talking about other lands. What's your experience in your own attempts to develop your own lands as to the tax policy of the state? What kind of comment you have? Of course, if nobody will come in, that's evidence that we've created a large enough disincentive. People are coming in, that would be evidence that there was still some incentive, or at least some projects. We hear bandied about that some corporations have very, very lucrative arrangements with some of the oil companies, and those arguments have been used by some to say that the state is not, for instance, getting as good a bargain for as high a level of return as the Navy corporations are. Those things are kind of fuzzy and hazy in the background. But I know the arguments are used. So for instance, somebody told me the other day, well, you're crazy for thinking you've reached a fair rate because the Navy corporations are going to get 50% of X or something or other, and we don't even approach that. Address that problem for to the extent that you can, and I don't want you to, don't expect you to violate your corporate confidences. I know that you have the same problems to some extent that the oil people who have talked to us do, I suppose, in the discussion of your business affairs. But to the extent that you feel that you can, I'd like to have your candid comments on those. I've heard some, as I say, but I've never had the opportunity to hear it and have it recorded and made a part of a record in a hearing like this. And I think it'd be an excellent opportunity.
Senator, if I may start with, I have spent most of my adult life in just that field. I was a deputy director for planning and development for the state of Oregon when my orders from the governor was to diversify the economy of the state of Oregon. I served on national boards on this subject matter. I was the first director of industrial development for the state of Alaska, and I helped diversify a major corporation in the United States into resource development. The subject matter that you discuss, and especially in the Oregon, which was at the time we started our work, was dependent on three different industries: fishing, lumber, and agriculture. The directive was broaden the base so that we can have and avoid the cycles that Senator Coleman has just spoken about, the cyclical instances of fishing, lumber, and agriculture. You know they all occur at a certain part of the year, so you go up and down all year round. The greatest issue that we face, and I think these companies are telling you is the stability and the predictability and the history of the tax structure of the state to which you're trying to attract somebody. When we competed with other states for that, we won hands down every time, because at that time the state of Oregon's tax structure had a stability over about a 20-year period that it was highly predictable. They could predict fairly well by the history of the tax structure and the business climate, therefore, of the state, what would happen in the future. And it's pretty well stayed the same. When we address this, as we are now, in things that we didn't know how to spell not too long ago, but we do have to face, when I say it was quite a stroke of business, in 1972 we did attract three major company groups, oil company groups, to do what wasn't able to be done in Alaska since Alaska started. And that was to go out on a gamble and do the geological and geophysical work of 13 million acres, from which we could choose five. They did that at tremendous investment on their part. They did that in 1972 when the tax structure of this state and your treatment of oil and gas companies was quite a bit different than it is now. And they don't know, and we would have a hard time, I would assume, now to predict, project that in the future, and there's a lot more to be done if it fluctuates each legislative session. Because these costs are amazing, and they don't know, and they haven't. And they haven't found, or they don't know what's going to come out the other end of the situation. But in this state, and in the Arctic Alaska, I can address very, very, very directly. In the bills that are before Congress, and the bills in the D2 area, you have amazing potential in the Arctic. How are we to get it out? Now, there are land schemes that are proposed by some people that would block the movement of goods of any kind, would block pipeline, would block corridor, would block the transportation systems so vitally necessary to do it. The state of Alaska, to this point in time, has not aided in this effort. And we intend fully to be full citizens of the state of Alaska, and we intend that our resources will be taxed to the benefit of all Alaskans and the United States. We need, on the other hand, what a government should provide. How do we develop our resources? And if we know how to develop our resources, we know how to employ people. And that is as great a need as monetary needs to our people. They want to have the job and the pride that goes with that sort of thing in developing their resources and telling them that they can pay their tax. So we, therefore, need a climate in which the state is not addressing itself to, well, I know what goes on in the State Department. If you have to address yourself to a major issue of a resource tax, the whole resource tax department is studying that. They're not doing something else. How do you help that state develop? Therefore get the tax. So that we would, what they have said, it is very true, is the tax and business climate of the state will either help generate the jobs and the potential of that state or deter from it. And we feel now, in trying to attract the capital, and we're hearing it very definitely, that it isn't there unless you can give us a more stable texture and posture of how it's to be treated if we do get there. You are more remote than the pipeline. Your areas are more remote. According to congressional activity and state activities, there may not be a way to get it out. According to environmental dictates, it may not be able to come out. The USGS has stated we have 4 trillion tons of coal. The Pipeline Act said you can't sell oil to Japan. We're closer to Japan. So they're trying to machinate the whole international system of oil delivery and transfer by some of our taxing and legislative schemes. The Japanese have some interest in our coal, and they can take it that way, but they can't predict what we're going to do. And we can't predict how it's going to happen because we can't predict environmental, tax, technical, and other things that are being constantly addressed or not addressed in the state. So we don't have a stable plan. It's the regional corporations and the 200 village corporations need the type of help that the state can give to it by creating a good business climate and by aiding them in that growth. It's not necessarily predicated that we are all going to be successful. And a lot of us may not make it if you look at an economic group cannot sell to market or get to market the very products of the land that we are about to own or do. Senator, I would say you make the same judgment in evaluating these budgets for yourself.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Slade?
Go ahead, yeah. Mr. Dineen, recognizing that a corporation can't tax, and therefore you might have a different royalty share than the state has, because I ask you this only because of the comment that was made that the natives might be taking so much more than the state is. Actually, have you ever made a comparison, that is without divulging any confidences, have you ever made a comparison between the value of your possible royalty share with a tax burden taken by the state of Alaska?
And would you say it was more or less, or?
Being a young firm and valuing our talent and stuff, no, we haven't been able to keep up. Really, the type of study you're talking about is very costly, takes a lot of time, and you change the rule every 2 years, or if not every year. I'm being very serious. It's very difficult for us to do that. But we are told that with companies that have the staff and the status, that it's hard to keep up, and they can't project that, but the constant change is something that they know is on. It does. We have attracted what we hope and what we believe are some of the major talents in this country in each one of these fields in which we're addressing. So we have arranged our contracts so that they have some of the floating stability necessary to meet these different changes. We have networking interests. We have working interests. We have royalty interests. But as I say, none of them are going to be much good to us if we can't produce and have some of them project income to us and keep us stable economically and fiscally if we can't get it moving in a predicted number of years.
May I ask that question, part of that question in a different way then? Whatever agreement you make as far as royalties go would be constant for the life of the contract.
Right.
As opposed to the fact that, as opposed to the taxing capability of the state of Alaska, which can fluctuate at whim almost, because they have a sovereign, because of their sovereign power.
That's true. Let's see if I missed your question or addressed.
What I'm getting at is this comment that was made, how we missed the boat.
You've missed the boat, and I don't think the native corporations and the and we do know quite a bit about each other now because we are thrown in the court with all our goodies. Everybody knows what everybody does because of the 7i lawsuit. And some are trying to extract 50 or an unreasonable percentage from the contracts that they're looking to find that out. Those aren't being very successful. We're finding out that a business deal has to be good for both sides. And if we try to extract too much, or far more, or a little bit more than the average that's done around the world, they slowly go away from our doors. It's got to fit some normal patterns. Of course, we do put in employment, and we want a good part, and we want a learning curve, and we want things of that nature. Things of that nature that will help the citizens grow and learn these sort of things. But otherwise, and those are all accounted for.
But in a general nature,
but you have it's a general agreement. But we're running across, and when I address it, point number one, if there's a Department of Revenue would be able to help us with the Internal Revenue Service problem. And I'll spell it out. They're trying to disallow any pre-operating costs. We can't expense them. They're trying to disallow any line selection costs. And they're trying to disallow and treat as income to the regional corporation any geological and geophysical work that was done for it. We know five that would break now, including us. We didn't receive any money in time. We didn't receive any direct service, but they're treating it that way. And the state of Alaska, by following its normal pattern, inadvertently falls in that same scope. So we're now in tax court. So we're in 7i court. So we're in court on how to get our land. So we're in court on how to get our D2. Gee, wait. And we're in court with the state of Alaska on NOOCs, whether it fits its enrollment pattern or not. And you agreed with us 4 years ago that it was all done, and we exchanged lands on it. Now we're in court with you. We're in court with the Internal Revenue Service. NAN spent $300,000 in court with the SEC. It's amazing the loopholes, the hurdles they can put you through. And as I say, just like every Western state, they didn't get their land. And Alaska will not get it unless you tend to going after it. And it's 6 years down the road and of the 40 million acres that your citizens will enjoy, you will have to be able to tax. There's only 3.8, 7 years down the road. And we've got 3.4. Now, you can either help us develop what the potential is by omission commission or deny us that help by the same sort of time. And there is, when I was with the state of Alaska, I delivered the presentation to the offshore conference in San Diego. You have 17 major provinces in oil and gas and minerals. 17. We found a few other things that you didn't know about because you gave the act gave us the ability to act on our own as a profit corporation, following the state laws, following the federal law. But we found amazing amounts of things that you will find about in the second session. But we've got to have some way to get it out. And it's hard to get it up from here, where the United States doesn't have a policy and the state of Alaska doesn't. But transportation is the only way we can sell it. And there are forces that would block it. Some of you know who they are. We need your help.
Madam Chairman, for the record, I note we have an additional witness at the table now. I don't know if he's going to testify or whether he's waiting to be heard or whether he's going to respond to some questions or what. But,
Madam Chairman, my name is W.C. Bishop. I'm manager of subsurface resources for Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Since Roger stepped out, perhaps I can sit here for a moment and answer Senator Rader's question about, as I understood it, what these various tax policies, what effect they have on the regions. I'll speak strictly for our own. I have managed about 3 million acres, if I ever get title to it, of land for both oil and gas and mining. And these mining companies watch what goes on in the legislature, especially on oil and gas. And the administration just recently introduced a bill, and I'm going to call the number right offhand, to increase the mining tax and also establish a severance tax on mining. And this caused one company we had an agreement with, an exploratory agreement, to, although that would even happen before the severance tax was introduced, to decide not to go ahead with another 5-year program. Then we had another company that was quite interested in picking up right there. This new tax was proposed, and the tax that you're talking about on oil and gas, and that was their major reason, that they couldn't see 5 years ahead. So if you keep talking about increasing taxes every year, you're definitely having an effect on our region and our development. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bishop. Senator Rader?
Let me ask you gentlemen again, if you can tell me, I hear rumors that the native corporations are the question is, what kind of opportunity do we have here? What kind of opportunity do you have on native lands? What kind of opportunity does the state have on state lands? And have we raised our level of taxation to the point that we're beginning to seriously diminish that opportunity? And someone said the other day, well, how would we objectively determine that? Well, if there's no more wildcatting done, that'd be one way of knowing that we've gotten out of line on it. We'd like to stop short of that. What other objective evidence might there be? And someone said, well, the fact that the native corporations are being able to drive a much better bargain for petrochemical or for petroleum exploration development than the state would indicate that the state had considerable leeway before they were creating, in effect, an unfavorable climate. Of course, that just all you have to do is to say, to what sands do you address yourself? Because the worse the sand, why, any taxes is going to cut it out. There's no question that we could develop non-developable sands if we had no taxes. That would be the optimum development level. But you've been in the oil business, and you have a unique opportunity now to view this from the point of view of the Native Corporation, our private landholders. What kind of deals are you able to drive? Do they indicate to you that we have reached a fair level of taxation, or we have exceeded a fair level of taxation, or that there's considerable leeway yet before we reach one? Now, I'd like to ask the same question to Mr. Dineen. Mr. Dineen addressed himself to the fact that major capital investment will not go into an unstable situation. And if the state taxing policy is unstable, as the last 6 years might indicate, if you were to project what's happened in the last 6 years into the future, it wouldn't take but a very few more years, and we know that there wouldn't be any drilling done. But assuming that we leveled off at some point, give us your best advice and your insight on where are we on the fair share from the point of view of precluding reasonable petroleum development. Exploration.
Well, Senator, that was kind of hard for me to answer because we just spend, or well, the other day, Tuesday, I believe, mm-hmm. officially.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at our region, I'm speaking only for our region. We have a joint agreement that covers our entire region with an oil company. But if we have a carried interest up until it's risk-free, in other words, up until the discovery is made, and then we have carried from there on this development money, but that's recovered out of a portion of our production. So once it's developed and then all the bills are paid, we would share 50-50.
More like the North Sea arrangement they described, where you, after the original investment is recouped, then you share in the net profits. Is that sort of the
yes.
arrangement?
Essentially, it sounds somewhat similar. So we look at it that when we put taxes on the oil industry, they say we just abandon a well, but if we had production, if it hadn't discovered something and we had it developed, we would essentially become a producing oil company, being subject to the same taxes as any other oil company, except we would be resident here in Alaska. I mean, we're Alaska Corporation, excuse me. So I think the taxes are high enough, frankly.
Could I interject one part of a question there? Do you also have a royalty interest besides that 50-50?
No.
Or is that the total thing?
No.
Thank you.
There's no front-end money?
No front-end money, no royalty.
No bonus?
Share,
no, no.
Share in the
share. That's the thing I have with my bonus.
I'd like to be able to ask the question now of one of the oil companies here. If they would like to redo things and just have everything,
yes,
and share 50-50 in the net profitability of Brutal Bay only, and no other taxes. That's what I like to do.
You may get the opportunity. The lands that we have selected in through the arrangements and agreements with the companies with whom we worked over, with number six, there are a number of acres that are designated that they have the right to lease or. That leaves us with a good deal of acreage to do something with. And the test of it would be there. Where can we get the dollars to do that on our land and invite the capital in and project to those people, convince them that their risk is worth the investment? and we can not only go through all the problems of determining and drilling and the cost of all that and finding that oil, and then getting it out somewhere. And that's going to take somebody with a lot of courage to convince that financier that that's there. We face that. In most cases, practically every case, we can't do it. It just isn't in it. The state of Alaska at this time. I'm afraid we're going to have to count on the industry that knows how to do it. And we don't get very far if badger or try to make a deal so extraordinary that they have to quietly, they have to treat you people, our state legislators, with deference. By God, they can tell us fast when we're trying to drive too hard a bargain. They just tell me we get the devil out of here. Nice your turn. They just leave. So they have that sort of an offer someplace else. And
I want to tell you, I haven't necessarily always been treated with that. I've been told to go a few places too.
I'll put it on the microphone.
Oh, yeah. All right. We are.
It's a wonder to watch them quietly try to answer your questions when you try to pin them on an issue that's so delicate.
Well, it is. It's an impossible kind of a question, and I don't expect any answer, but that's the kind of question that the newspapers and the voters ask of us. And the next time you run for office did this guy vote for the fair share of the oil industry taxation? And somebody has to stand up on radio or television or talk to the people in a political sense. Yes, we did get the fair share, or no, we didn't get the fair share, and there's good guys and bad guys based upon whether or not they voted for or against a fair share. All I'm trying to do is to develop some sort of a record here that people, when we get through with what we've done, that people can look at it and say, were we at a reasonable rate, an excessive rate, or are we below it and being patsies by not raising? And you happen to be the only private landowners that have testified, and just about the only private landowners that we have in existence in the state. And so your point of view then is different than ours from the state point of view. The state is an entrepreneur, but we can't separate our entrepreneurial land ownership from our tax and our sovereignty, whereas you do that very quickly because you don't have that ability to make a good deal bad or a bad deal good by second guessing with governmental powers. You have to contract through. Because you are the only ones who have testified and who are in a position to testify on that, your testimony is uniquely important, I think, and your judgments are uniquely important in helping us assess whether or not we're at a fair share level of taxation on the petroleum industry.
But we must be very frank that yes, when your decisions affect Wall Street, like they did once, on a public thing of that nature, you sneeze and they've got pneumonia back there. We deal in that quietly every day in trying to address the dollars that are necessary to get done what you want done. We want something different. We want to, it's awfully hard when the public studies and the testimony show us through you that yes, you are, including royalty that you have your share of, and tax, and severance, and income, and the total package, you are getting at least as much. I think those studies show that you're getting as much as any state except Louisiana, and I don't think Louisiana has the royalty. So you throw that on top, and you're sitting pretty. Now, when you want to do that, and then you're projecting in your own study, some places in the nature of several 100% increase in tax, in order to build up a fund, then we're judged by, are you meeting the current needs and services of your people, or are you becoming as guilty as those you accuse of trying to get more than your share? You've got to look at it from that point of view. Are we getting greedy as a state, or covetous?
is this happening here too? We say the big, bad, dirty oil companies are rich and filthy rich because they're trying to strap. We can't prove it, but we say it. Some say it. And on the other hand, are we guilty of the same thing? When we want more than our current needs? Senator Huber asks, well, are the people of the Arctic getting the services, or will they want more from the state? That hasn't been addressed. Just because you're going to get more funds, you're talking about putting it into a permanent fund. You're not talking about putting it into the bush. You really are not. No, you're talking about 25, 50, or 100% into a permanent fund. That's not talking about where you're going to distribute that revenue at all. No way. But let's turn it around. These people have the same tools as all of you have had now for years since the country was born. They now have these tools, and they want to say, we'll produce our jobs. We'll develop these lands, or not, as they desire, as a good old landowner can do, choose to do either way. But enough of them are saying, we would produce the jobs if you just help us like any other state would, and give us the incentive and the push and the motivation to do that. You've got enough resources in the state to produce the resources that will produce the income that you want from the tax. Just let the people do it. The state doesn't have to if you help the people. And you got amazing people out there ready to go. Just help them. Help them clear the hurdles.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Huber?
I wanted to ask him one question. If you didn't think maybe the $500 million we're paying into the Native corporations out of state's resource money, all of them are resource money, isn't doing exactly that. And I'm not talking against you, but we're giving you the money that you need right now from the very scraps of your share.
I hope you do that, sir, while the corporations need it the worst.
It's in these bills. I want that.
You've got to get that pipeline going so you get some income so you can pay those.
They've been getting it every year, Madam Chair. Every single year, whether the pipeline is flowing or not, as the state gets its revenue, you're getting your percentage of it coming off of resources that's going directly to the Navy funds to fund the front end money that you need right now.
Sure, it's very low at the moment. As soon as you get pipeline money, oil going on that pipeline will work out. It seems same as our answer. The regional corporations must share the income from under 7i. We will share 70% of everything we get from oil and gas with all the other regional corporations, therefore every Native stockholder in Alaska. The other corporations will share what they come from mining, if that happens to be what's under in or on the properties that they have. And the others will share timber. You tell me what the state of Alaska is doing to help engender the production of mineral, timber, or oil and gas.
I'd like to try that, Madam Chairman. This committee killed the governor's ill-conceived plan to tax the mineral industry that didn't exist and don't exist. And killing that plan, if there had been a goose there to lay a golden egg, I think it would have been right for us to get a piece of gold off the egg. But there wasn't any golden egg, and there wasn't any goose there. But we did take a leadership position
in
killing.
I'm asking, what are you doing to motivate?
To motivate?
A tremendous resource has been created in your state.
Well, is it half a million dollars a year? To the only thing that we can possibly do with the feds. I listened to you here today blame the state of Alaska, I think, for most of what the feds are doing, not purposely, but that's what it really amounts to, because the Joint Federal Land Use Planning Commission, which we fund 50% of, that is the only major effort taking place to try to straighten up these things that you're talking about, that makes it so that they can't develop the resources in Alaska, lack of transportation, lack of everything. And we're all stymied by the same thing.
Let's get our heads together.
Well, we should get our heads together. And I want one more thing, Madam Chairman, if we may. You testified that these rate tax increases, and I've got trouble figuring out what you mean, because the administration severance tax increase proposes a raise from about 8% to about 10%. The income tax proposals we have here propose that the tax that your corporation has to pay on its net profits, 9.4% of net profits, when you are taxable to the state of Alaska, that those things would be transferred to the oil companies, who only presently pay between 2 and 3% effective taxation of their corporate profits. And yet, you and I, in the corporate interest, we would have to pay 9.4% for individuals. One hell of a lot more. And I don't know of any plans before us to confiscate or tax greater amounts of income. Is there, Madam Chairman, that we are really out to other this year, other than to adjust the 9.4% corporate income tax and a slight raise and adjustment in the severance tax? Isn't that all we have before us?
Well, it depends on your definition of slight, Senator Huber, but...
Well, from 8% to something under the 12% that Louisiana tax. You can call it, the worst bill I think is about 3 to 4%, and the governor's bill with its sliding scale is 10%, I understand.
Now, Senator, if I can answer that in a different way. Prudhoe Bay is 450,000 acres or something like that, isn't that right? The native claim back is 40 million. All we're saying is that possibly you're guilty of myopia. You're zeroing in so hard on that and trying to get and preserve for the future and the culture and the heritage of the kids and the grandkids, everything out of that one little pot. And you've got 360 million acres you're looking at. And what you do to those people there affects how well we can get going. If you turn them off there, and they're stuck there, I grant you they're stuck there, they got to get it out of there. But they won't go to the next place, and that's on our lands. They've got to be encouraged, just like you would have to be encouraged to come, and we'll ask you to do what you want to do or go into business. They can't face that harassment, although the constant change. And we want them to help us, but if they're going to face it at Prudhoe Bay, just as they said, that's going to show them they're going to face it wherever else they are. Look at the treatment the borax people are getting. Is that encouragement? That's
Fed
jobs.
Isn't that by the feds instead of the state?
The state is asking for delay to look at the EIS statement. And I'll tell you what that does in the Arctic. The financiers are asking for a delay on ours because they don't know what we're doing because we don't know what you're doing. All right? A 30 to 60 to 70 day delay on our financing of a building puts it off for a year. Because by the time you got the stuff up there, you would be building it in 50 degree low weather, and your workforce can only produce about 20% of their normal. So just delay us a little bit, you delay us a year. It's those little things. The whole attitude over you, you want them to help develop jobs for your citizens, or you want to make it as difficult as possible. And you want to extract all the money you can from one little place, and they do. You, if you were spun that way, you'd also look at your whole card the next time you made an investment. Where you go, you might look for a more friendly place.
Thank you, Mr. Dineen. Bishop, Mr. Levitt.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you.
We do have...
You've given us more time.
Mr. Wilson, who has been waiting very patiently to discuss the severance tax with us.
Yes. We frequently exercise bad judgment, but it wasn't today. And this is really.
Larry, can we have a 5-minute break before you start?
Severance tax.
A severance tax.
Page 23.
We're done with it.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
time. I had planned to move on next to SC202, but I think the hour is late, and we do have a few more things I think that we would like to get into. I think I will, your permission, I think I'll skip that part. As you know, I testified on this last year. You do have that testimony in your records, and I can't add a great deal to what's there, but there is something that will be included in my remarks, the written statement.
That choices, yeah.
If that's all right with you.
That's fine, thank you.
I'll get it out.
I'd like now to direct my comments to the Legislative Council's proposed production tax changes incorporated in identical bills SC103 and HD144. Following that, I'll take up the administration's bill, which is the severance tax bill, which is HD321, and then the companion bill. With respect to SC103, the proposal was, one, change the point at which the taxable value of oil is determined from the well, the point where oil is first metered or measured in the condition of pipeline quality. We also realign the so-called stair-step tax rates, lowering the tax on the first 1,000 barrels per well per day, and substantially raise the tax on all production over the first 1,000 barrels, with a high rate of 14% on all production exceeding 3,500 barrels per day. The third thing we do, we use lease or property averaging in determining each well's daily production. Four, we tax flared gas at 5 times the normal rate. And the last major feature, we will advance the monthly tax due date to the 20th day of the month following the month of production. Adoption of lease or property averaging with daily barrels per well production is a step in the right direction in properly ascertaining the stair-step tax rates applicable to a field. This change, we think, will, of course, aid both the taxpayer and the state administratively. The resultant increase in the overall industry tax burden, estimated by the Legislative Affairs Agency, to be about $180 million per year by 1980, is completely unwarranted, considering the question of need which others have already addressed, and considering the fact that Alaska oil is already being taxed at virtually the highest level in the nation. The limited benefit given to the lower producing fields in Cook Inlet in no way justifies in no way should be considered a justification or a basis of consistency for placing such a harsh extra tax on high-producing wells in the North Slope or any other location. This approach portrays the concept of taxing the taxpayer at a high level, not on the basis of state government needs, which we believe to be grossly unfair. Retention of the alternate cents per barrel floor rate with its wholesale price index adjustments more than counteracts any true benefit out of reduced rates given low Cook Inlet producing wells through percentage rate reduction. As the Levy Associates have maintained, this minimum price setting device
has created an artificially high value on the old coconut oil for tax purposes, resulting in an effective tax rate well in excess of what we believe was intended by the legislature on such oil. Let me digress from my remarks just for a second. Last time I checked this for Indian Oil and the parties for whom we report taxes, the cents per barrel, it cost us about $5 million additional. We feel that that's simply a form of a windfall that sort of fell on the state's lap as a result of the cents per barrel that was put on a few years ago. We do not see any justification for imposing a penalty rate, which is 5 times normal rate for flared gas, considering the fact that such flaring controls are best placed with regulatory agencies and not tax abusers. If proper regulatory authority exists to flare gas, such as for safety purposes, there is no justification for adding tax at a confiscatory rate to a product that the producer loses through flaring. Oh, when we get to the other bill, I want to come back to this same feature because it's in the other bill also. Moving the point of measurement of production value downstream to the point of metering in a condition of pipeline quality could unjustly place a substantial tax on transportation costs on some fuels, which for a variety of reasons require measurement of oil significant distance. Movement of oil significant distances before measurement. Since the Alaska production tax is an occupation tax on the privilege of severing oil and gas, it would be more appropriate to continue measuring it by its value at the point of severance, that is, at the wellhead, instead of adding on to it incremental values of gathering, transportation, and field treatment. Last thing I want to talk about on this bill is the advancement of the payment date from the end of the month to the 20th of the month. This is one of those types of provisions that you find in a tax bill once in a while that's sort of housekeeping and it seems innocuous and not very controversial. But you see this happening all over the United States. Advancement of tax date when you get the money just a little bit earlier, a little bit earlier, a little bit earlier. This really raises the dickens with the accounting section. 20 days is not very much time. That's really only, sometimes that's only 13, 14 work days. And to get all that information and get it correlated and translated into a tax return really puts the companies under a bind. And unless there's a real need for that, pushing it up by 10 days, because you're only getting 10 days total anyway, we'd like to see that provision stricken out and kind of forgotten, because the accounting section is just screaming every time they see that sort of a provision. My next comments pertain to HB 321 and the companion bill SB 238, which are identical bills, which contain the administration's recommended changes to the oil and gas production tax. Briefly, the bill would replace the present stair-step tax rates on oil production per well with a single rate of 10% on value, or one alternative minimum cents per barrel rate of 75 cents, adjusted for gravity and for changes in the gross national product equator. Also, the 4% rate on gas would increase to 10%, with a new alternative minimum tax of 6.4 cents per MCF. The new percentage rate and the cents per unit rates would be adjusted by an economic limit factor called ELF, which I will discuss and go into a lot more detail a little bit later. The proposal also makes other changes, including changing the point of measurement from the wellhead to the point of measurement of pipeline quality,
proposal also imposes a double rate of tax on flared gas. We strongly oppose the perpetuation of the cents per barrel floor prices and expansion of it to gas production, as well as increasing the minimum price to which it relates, that is $7.50 a barrel. As Milton Lipton has advised, the current floor has escalated by the National Wholesale Crude Price Index, has worked in unintended ways on cooking of crude, creating an artificial taxing value well in excess of the value permitted by the FDA on oil. Now the administration not only recommends continuance of the minimum price concept, but also proposes to increase the minimum price to $7.50 a barrel. Although the administration supports this course with the argument that the FDA price is artificially low, but the oil companies producing such old oil nevertheless suffer the economic realities of federal pricing. Accordingly, we believe it is unfair that in addition to bearing such economic loss in price, the cook inlet producer must also bear an increase in production tax because of an arbitrary floor of $7.50 per barrel used as a measurement of tax. This, of course, would be equally true on the North Slope if the FDA placed a value below $7.50 on that production. We fail to see any justification for the state to arbitrarily burden the production with such a heavy production tax to an artificially set value because of the possibility that the FDA's pricing decisions may not be favorable. As mentioned above, HD 321 introduces the concept of an economic limit factor as an adjustment to the percentage rate of tax applied to both oil and gas. According to the Department of Revenue's February 1975 study, they believe that the present stair-step rate schedule does not adequately take into account differences in the economic conditions existing from field to field. For example, a well producing 1,000 barrels per day at one location may be marginal, while such a producing rate at another location may be profitable. In short, the stair-step approach is deemed effective because it does not adequately protect against excessive taxation as a well produces approaches its economic limit. To correct this, the department proposes an ELF, the calculation of which begins by determining the fraction. I want to go over this carefully. This is a very complex part of this bill, and I've got a handout here. In just a minute, I'll give you an example, because I think the way to go through this is through the mechanism of an example. The department proposes an ELF, the calculation of which begins by determining a fraction, the numerator of which is the monthly production rate at the economic limit. The denominator is the production during the month for which the tax is to be paid. Under HD 321, the numerator is by statute deemed to be 100 barrels times the number of well days. Well days are, by definition, the number of days a well is operating. Thus, if there were 10 wells on a lease operating for 28 days each, the numerator would be 100 times 10 times 28, or 28,000 barrels. If the total monthly production on the lease was 280,000 barrels, then the ratio would be 10%, or expressed as a decimal, 0.10. The next step is determining the ELF is to reduce unity, that is 1.00, by the ratio expressed as a decimal. Thus, 1 minus 0.10 equals 0.90. That is the ELF. Now, the best way to explain this, how the HD321 mechanism works, through a simplified example, which I believe Whalen just passed out to you. The example uses Cook Inlet production of 35 degree oil at a $4.85 per barrel control price. Under the bill, one of the adjustments is a half a cent for each degree above 27 degrees. So 4 cents is added to the 75 cents. You'll see that in the right side of the column. That's nothing more than 8 degrees times a half a cent, which is 4 cents. So the rate is not 75, it's adjusted up to 70. 79. The GMP deflator adjustment, which is also in the bill, has been ignored because the base starting point is the first quarter of 1977, so I've ignored that in the example. The statutory presumption of 100 barrels is the numerator. In the example, what I got, 1,600 barrel a day well, then 1,600 becomes the denominator. Which gives you a decimal of 0.0625. And when subtracted from 1.00, gives an ELF of 0.9375. Both the cents per barrel of 79 cents and the 10% rate is multiplied by 0.9375 to find the adjusted cents per barrel and percent of value rates. Next, the royalty of 200 barrels is subtracted to find 1,400 non-royalty barrels. Finally, the 1,400 barrels are multiplied by the value of $4.85 and then by the 9.375% rate to find the tax under the percent of value rate. And also the same ELF factor is multiplied by 79 cents to arrive at the 0.7406 cents. Those are the numbers that you're finally getting down, trying to get down to. The 9.375 is the percentage rate, and your final adjusted rate that you actually multiply by your barrel is 0.7406. In the example, the $1,036.84 is obviously higher than the $636 figure under the percent of value calculation. Therefore, in the example, the $1,036 would be the higher, and therefore the tax payable. At the bottom of the example, the tax under HB321 is compared with the tax that's produced from the same production if it occurred this month, March 1977. Under current law. As shown, the increase is about 60%. Also at the bottom of the example, it is shown that the effective rate on the production tax under current law would be about 9.5%, but 15.3% under HD321. I ran a calculation out on this last night, and if the production had been cut in half, the 800 barrels, the increase in tax over the current tax, I think, would have jumped up to about 75%. The reason for that is that you've got all barrels coming out of the well, in this example, are going to be taxed at 74 cents. Whereas under the current law, the first few barrels out of the well are taxed at a lower rate, therefore, cut the production. The production goes down, actually, the effective for the amount of increase will go up. As mentioned earlier and used in the example, the monthly production rate at the economic limit is by statute presumed to be 100 barrels times well days. Unless the producer, in a formal hearing, proves by, quote, clear and convincing evidence that it is otherwise. However, to prove this, HD 321 contains some rather curious and questionable ground rules which just simply don't track with reality. These provisions are found in subsections B, C, and D of 43.55013. In essence, the average monthly direct operating cost based on at least four consecutive months is divided by the value at the point of production of oil, which is produced from the lease. But this value is not the value the producer actually gets, but rather that value which is deemed by the authors to be the value of comparable crude at West Coast refineries for imported oil, which is then backed out to the wellhead. What I'm talking about here is how you determine the economic limit of the field. The concept is buried in this statute. What they are doing here is taking your direct operating cost in the field over a four-month period, and then you divide that by the value. The value, however, is the not necessarily the value that the producer gets for his oil. For instance, the Cook Inlet. You would think you would use $4.85 because that's what you get for the oil. But under this provision, the value that you divide into those costs is the oil at the West Coast of the United States, which is the comparable oil to the oil, let's say, in the Cook Inlet. That's Indonesian crude oil at $14.50 a barrel into LA, backed out at about a dollar to New Drift River and to the Cook Inlet. And you end up with a wellhead value of $13.50. So that under this provision, what you're trying to do is arrive at the numerator of that fraction. It's the numerator in the bill is an assumed 100 barrels, and you're stuck with that unless you can prove otherwise. And what I'm getting into here is how you prove otherwise, which the value that you use to divide into, you've got to use the comparable crude to LA. Backed out, or the West Coast, I should say, backed out to the wellhead.
Can I ask a brief question here, Madam Chairman? Isn't that in effect what the FEA does for the producer's share of the oil from that marginal well anyway? Isn't that exactly what they do? We had that testified to us yesterday, that your producer's share, when the well goes down to its economic limit, is then priced at the higher oil price instead of being priced at the $5 and something a barrel. Now, we have that in direct testimony yet. Could you comment on it? From Sterling Gallagher, when he explained it.
I do not profess to be an FDA expert. There may be others here in the room who can answer that, but they're not.
I don't know the answer to that particularly, but correct me if I'm wrong. The proviso is that you're backing out transportation costs from that foreign location. You're not moving up to Alaska in this computation that they're creating. In other words, is this correct? You're taking the West Coast prize as a reference price and going back to the foreign location.
Madam Chairman, being we don't know the answer, we can wait until we get Sterling on that. Because that particular provision, I just wanted to call attention to it, unless you could explain it. That particular provision, that's how he described to us that the producer's share was handled at that economic limit well. And if it isn't, that needs adjusting.
Well, whether it is or isn't, the bottom line is in that example that I showed you.
I think Mr. Olney
got a comment about it.
I'm just going to make a point on that. While such an adjustment procedure may exist under the FDA regulation, we've canvassed the delegation and been unable to find anybody that is aware that it's ever been applied. That's the problem. And severance tax raised 4 years ago in Louisiana, and there's been no adjustment for those severance tax increases in Louisiana, and they were doubled. So, yeah, you can talk about there perhaps being a procedure under FDA regulations, but if you can't, if nobody's able to get the adjustment out of the procedure, it's not worth very much. That's my response.
Madam Chairman, Sterling Gallagher informs that that was applied in Alaska to the producer's share starting in December of this last year and was disallowed for the royalty share at the same time. That procedure.
Mr. Showalter.
My recollection of that testimony is that he said they allowed enough increase in the price of the producer's share of the oil to cover the direct operating costs of the well, not the foreign price, but just enough to cover the direct operating costs of the well, and they did disallow it for the royalty share.
Well, in regard to this alternate procedure, Madam Chairman, we'll have to make a note and make sure that we get that equitable.
Anyway, up to this point, I've spoken. How do you, in other words, the figure that you divide into the cost, at least for cooking a producer, fictitious price, because you are backing that out of Los Angeles, which is deemed to be a competitive imported oil, which would be Indonesian crude oil. Now, using that, that's bad enough, but with regard to the so-called, quote, direct operating expenses that are allowed, the bill only allows four. Drilling supplies, fuel, routine maintenance, and wages and benefits of employees working on production operations. Specifically excluded are capital expenditures, tangible or intangible drilling costs, expenses, costs of work, well workovers, costs for repairs or replacements other than routine maintenance, depreciation or amortization, taxes, insurance, overhead, or monies paid or set aside to cover the cost of terminating operations, that is, abandonment costs. Allowing only four listed costs is not realistic because there are cash operating costs not allowed, but which are tied to operations versus no operations. Any cash costs which would be affected by a decision to operate or not operate is the realistic approach and more in line with the way it would actually be approached by a producer in a true situation. HB 321 would even deny severance taxes on the production itself and property taxes on the equipment. I requested Union Oil's Oil and Gas Division engineer to run some calculations using real data as a test. Doing it in the normal way, our people used a realistic value of about $4.85 a barrel for value, and the real operating cost to get an ELF of about 0.67. But by using $13.50 a barrel as the value and limiting the cost to the four categories, this ELF was around 0.92. Now that's a big difference. We also made a rough comparison of the taxes under HB 321 compared with taxes paid in 1976 and found that the tax on oil production would have increased by about 50% if HB 321 had been in effect for 1976. HB 321 also contains an ELF for gas production, though it's not totally clear to me under the bill language just how this is computed. In any event, the principle is the same, and the same four direct operating costs are used, but the value that you use for gas is the counterpart to the, in my example of the Indonesian crude in West Coast backed out. The counterpart for gas is the highest price in the field or within 100 miles. With respect to gas production, the minimum of 6.4 cents per MCF is especially onerous. Since gas is customarily sold in a long-term contract, and those contracts may not permit the seller to receive a value which happens to be the highest price in the lease or within 100 miles. The 6.4 cents minimum tax is equal to 64 cent gas at a 10% rate. but there are contracts of sale for gas where the price is much less than 64 cents. Hence, the effective rate of tax on gas is much higher. For example, if gas were sold at 42 cents, the tax would be, and the taxes would have still a minimum of 6.4 cents, and assuming there was no ELF involved, this would equate to a tax rate of 15.2%, effective rate. With respect to the proposed gas rate increase, while admittedly the gas tax rate might warrant some degree of increase, the severity of this proposal is overreaching. We would suggest that any value tax on gas be based on actual sales price at the sales meter. We would discourage taxation governed by an artificial floor price, or by what some other producer may be receiving for his gas in some other field. For flared gas, the rate is double, that is 12.8 cents. Even gas used for safety flaring necessary for safe operations would be taxed, which cannot be justified by any standard. We oppose this double tax for the same reason as stated in the discussion under SB 103. By the way, I talked to some Marathon people, and just on their safety flares, they calculate that this tax would cost them over $100,000. This is just like a pilot light on your stove, needed for safety purposes. In summary, while there is merit to the concept of an ELF